Today is May 16th, 2011, and you're listening to Real Food, Real Life. I'm your host and registered dietitian, Christina Petit of Eating the Good Life with ChristinaPetit.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jerrica Cadman of ShadyGrove.net, ShadyGroveRanch.net, I always mess that up, and TrueFields.com. Today we are going to talk about stretching a chicken, how to stretch your food budget money in these economic times. I know as soon as we start talking about eating healthy, people immediately grab their wallet in fear. And yeah. How do you afford that? How can you do that? So that's what we're going to talk about today, stretching your chicken. First, I'll start off with a little bit of news. I don't know if this came out, I think at the end of April, so it's a little bit old now. But recent research coming out of France has found that there are three different intestinal types. Have you heard about this?
I saw this article. I didn't read it, but I did see it today.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Three enterotypes, and they're noted by the different concentrations of different bacteria. So they've narrowed it down to about three different types, gut types, intestine types, according to the bacterial makeup. It's fascinating. They have been able to predict disease by the genes in those microbes more accurately than going by the genes in the person's body. So we're talking obesity risk, diabetes risk, intestinal cancers, Crohn's, predicting all kinds of diseases.
So mostly intestinal-related diseases?
No, not necessarily. Oh, not really? All. Not all. I mean, obesity is not an intestinal disease.
You know, they say that the gut is the heart of your immune system, basically.
It is. It is. I mean, you learn that. I mean, I think doctors even learn that in medical school. We definitely learned that in school as becoming a dietitian. It dictates what comes in and out of your body, what gets absorbed and what doesn't get absorbed. Hmm.
People don't normally think of your intestines as what, you know, gets you over a cold or gets you through the pneumonia or, you know, whatever, but it's just interesting that those things are related.
Yeah, we've known that the gut is the immune system, but knowing that we can predict that by the bacterial makeup, I mean, we always knew a healthy gut had good bacteria, but knowing that you can evaluate the genes in the different microbes, that's very, very interesting. And definitely, also dictates the different gut types they've found dictate how you utilize medications and metabolize those, how you metabolize vitamins and minerals and uptake. And
people who have their colons removed can't really absorb vitamin B at all.
Right.
They don't have the right bacteria.
Right, yeah.
Interesting.
So what they're thinking now is if somebody had, the way they want to use this science is if somebody has diabetes or an increased risk of obesity, they want to implant more of implant bacteria from a good type into their system to make them have this gut type. But what I'm wondering, and they're not saying this at all, so it might be something that they're still researching or they've already knocked out as not a possibility, I don't know. But if your gut type, I mean, the first thing I'm going to assume, your gut type is related to your past history of what you've eaten, what antibiotics you've taken, your whole health, because we know that you can improve gut health. So that's automatically where my mind goes with this, and not being thoroughly educated on these new gut types. I don't know if this is in a different direction than that, going beyond what we manipulate with our diet and health and for gut health, if this is different, if this is inborn bacteria, I don't know. It'll be interesting to find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, babies are born sterile, so you pick up all your bacteria.
You build it.
Environmentally, yeah. So, I mean, people are so germaphobe today, and I guess they're just afraid of all kinds of germs, but they don't realize everything has germs, good and bad germs. You know, not all germs are bad or evil or disease-causing. And I would venture to say it's better to be exposed to good bacteria than no bacteria at all.
Oh,
so, anyway, but that's not
it's
really
impossible not to. It's not even
an
option.
You have to encounter bacteria, so you better not kill off all the good stuff hopes of killing off a few bad ones. Anyway, so
it's very interesting how they'll use this science. I just hope it's not used by a drug company to, oh, you have this bacteria, so you need to take this drug because you might get this.
Well, and, you remember that last, maybe a couple podcasts ago, we talked about the study that I had read where they were basically trying to say, if we eliminate all bacteria in the gut, then we can control, you know, X, Y, Z, whatever. I forget what it was, but yes. I was like, oh, that's scary.
Yeah, that is. It's interesting science. I would like to study it a little bit more and find out the nuances of
this. We've heard of like fecal transplants, which is sort of what that article is implying, where, you know, you take, if you're one type that's more prone to a particular disease, they want to put these other bacteria in your gut so that you'd be less prone. And you know, they found that fecal transplants for people with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and maybe even diverticulitis, just the lower intestine problems, have really benefited from being having a transplant of good bacteria into their gut. And that basically happens by transplanting a culture of someone else's gut bacteria, aka poop, into your gut. So it's kind of weird and very seemingly backwards, because we always think of, you know, feces as extremely disgusting and dirty, and you would never even want to touch them, much less put them in your body. But it's just interesting that they found that that actually helps cure diseased guts by transplanting poop. So,
well, some people are hypothesizing that what we'll find out by these three different gut types is that because some people do good with more protein, some people do good with less protein, some people just seem to do better on a lot of vegetables and, you know, different ratios. Some people just seem to thrive better on different ratio of fat, carbs, and protein. And some people are hypothesizing that we'll find out that these are the people that, according to their butt type.
According to their butt type, a.k.a. their bacteria in their gut.
According to their gut type, we'll find out that some people just digest vegetables better. Some people...
It makes sense.
Digest, yeah. So, well, you know, and then that corresponds with, if you throw that off kilter, you have somebody that does not tolerate grains. Eating a high grain diet, obviously, is going to develop the gluten issues and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, like people think about when you switch your dog's dog food, you have to do it really slowly because a lot of dogs respond badly to rapid changes in diet. And it's because of bacteria in their gut. It's not, there's no other reason, I don't think. Not that I'm aware of anyway, but it's because they're, the same thing with a cow, their rumen, you know, or the bacteria in their gut have to adapt to whatever's in their diet at that time. And they say in humans that it takes about 3 days to start really producing the enzymes that you need to digest some new food.
Yeah.
Which is why a lot of people, you know, have problems eating beans all of a sudden. And then, you know, maybe if they keep eating the beans a couple of days later, they're okay. Some people it's the other way around, but anyway. But it has to do with enzyme production. Your body responds to, you know, what you're eating by just giving it time, so.
Yeah. Interesting science. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I would like to definitely learn more about that. Very, very interesting. Another story I found in the New York Times that came out over the weekend, I think on Saturday. The title of the story was Foods with Benefits, or So They Say. And it's an article on functional foods, which, if you don't know what functional foods are, they're foods that are, it's more of a marketing term. It's a term we study in nutrition, but it's also more of a marketing term. Like, for example, oatmeal being high in fiber, they can say it's a functional food because if you eat that, supposedly it will lower your risk for heart disease. Mm-hmm. So this article was talking about all the marketing that's going on right now in the functional food world, and is it better for you or not? And basically, they have just gone, the food industry has always used health claims to sell food, but apparently it's gotten so out of hand lately that there are lawsuits going left and right, having companies pull ads because they have stretched a tiny study that might show something. They've extrapolated it to their product, who barely has any simulation to the original things studied, and are you know, launching multi-million dollar ad campaigns to sell their products with great success.
Yeah.
And it's very manipulative of the public. And we've talked about it on the podcast before. If someone's selling something with a health claim, Don't buy it.
It's probably no good. Don't chocolate buy it. Rice Krispies. Cocoa has been proven to
Rice Krispies was one of the ones.
Oh, really?
They apparently were claiming that it improves, help improve your family's immunity. Eat Rice Krispies.
Oh, gosh.
And they're not even stating a reason why. We have this, we have that. And the little Rice Krispie guys have on superhero capes, and they're helping the families, you know. And they had to yank that ad, obviously. I can't even imagine what their claim would have been. Usually I can figure out what their angle is. But anyway, everything and on your shelves just about has some kind of claim. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and sometimes it's as simple as, it's as silly as, this company can afford the high marketing to develop this ad program with this health claim, and the generic doesn't, and doesn't have it on their box, and people are going to spend more to buy the exact same thing that has the health claim as the generic, when both of them are probably irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It's a big marketing ploy, but I was glad to see this go mainstream in the New York Times, that they were reporting on this, not to waste your money, because they charge so much more if they put a health claim on there, because it can be marketed as a health food, and we all know health foods are more expensive.
But they're worth it.
But they're worth it.
If General Mills makes it, it's worth it.
General Mills, Kellogg's got knocked, a lot of them. It's just another, it just backs up what we've said before, but I'm glad that it was going mainstream and saying that because it has a health claim doesn't mean it's anything. I was a dietitian. We have to do continuing education hours, and I think it was last spring that I did continuing education on functional foods, and I've told you about this before, I think, Jerrica. I was so frustrated by everything I'd read. We have found this compound in this food, and we found that it's good for this, this, and this. But when we isolate it and take it out of the food and try to use it as a supplement or fortify it in other foods that don't naturally have this, it doesn't work. Well, no joke. I mean, if it just did it one time, it would not be frustrating. But then we'd move on to the next functional food, and we have isolated this compound in this food, and it helps with this and this. But when we take it out, it doesn't seem to have the same effect. Well, when they're making these Frankenfoods, they don't have to put that. We don't get the same results when we mutilate it and put it in this form. But studies show that in its natural form, exactly it helps. So you don't get that missing link that we found it in its natural source helping, not when we've mutilated it, repackaged it, and selling a really cheap product marketed with this great health ad, and we can increase the price, and there's a huge profit margin.
Right.
It's very frustrating. Frustrating as a healthcare professional, because it's just, for every one time you may hear somebody say this or read this in the New York Times, you are getting hours and hours and hours of commercials on that TV and on the radio and on your internet ads that pop up on websites, and it's hard to combat all the false information with real information.
Well, and what they've done, and this is true of genetically modified foods too, is they, you know, like you said, they take some compound or whatever and substitute it into this food, and they can say, you know, oh, well, you know, this has been shown to do this, you know, thing, or to be safe to be eaten, like with genetically modified organisms. Basically, FDA has said, well, you don't, you know, it's basically the same as real food, so you don't have to do any additional testing. You only have to test on new products, brand new products. So in other words, like your Rice Krispies, if they take genetically modified rice and stick it in there, they don't have to do any testing to see if it's actually safe for human consumption. Basically, we're all guinea pigs. And it's the same thing with the fortified vitamins and this and that. They haven't tested the product to see if it actually promotes your health like they say it's going to. It's just, you know, like Christina was saying, it happened to do it in this particular scenario, you know, anyway, it's just...
When it was a real food.
Right. Back when it was a real food before we processed it to death.
It's frustrating, but I was glad to see that someone took that on, and major brands too, General Mills and Kellogg's and the Danone yogurt, and which I love Jamie Lee Curtis, and I'm sure she has good intentions when she is promoting Activia. I'm sure I think she's great, but anyway, misled, but great. It was an interesting article. I'll definitely put a link to it in the show notes page, as well as the gut types. I'm interested to read more about the gut types in the future.
Very nice.
So, Jerrica, talk some chicken to us.
Yes. Well, you know, a good segue into how to stretch a chicken is just, you know, like we were saying, with, you know, just because a food is marketed as healthy doesn't necessarily mean that it is healthy, and foods that are generally recognized as healthy don't necessarily have to be more expensive either. But sometimes they are, and that's a reality. Naturally raised stuff tends to be a lot more expensive, which is silly because, I mean, it seems so backward. It's like the more processed it is, the cheaper it is. But the more natural it is, the more you have to pay. Why is that? Well, part of it is shelf life. Part of it is quality. And you know, if you can stick a million chickens in one house and raise them all and keep them, you know, blocked off from toxins and wild birds and, you know, air, sunshine, whatever, then you can control the outcome of that much more, you know, than if you had free-ranged the birds. So it costs a lot more to raise things naturally. You know, vegetable-wise and otherwise, because like with organic practices for vegetables, you lose a lot more to crops and deer and wildlife and things like that. Oh, did I say crops? I meant bugs. Yeah, you lose a lot of your crops to bugs. But, you know, you'll hear organic farmers just say, well, you just have to plant enough for the bugs. You just have to plant enough, you know, to have a little extra that you might, you know, anticipate losing. And, of course, the conventional model, you know, it's so humongous, so large scale that it's like, you know, if a loss occurred, it would be a very, very large loss. So they have to eliminate all losses whatsoever. Whereas a small diversified farm that raises a little bit of crops, a little bit of grains, a little bit of cows, a little bit of sheep, one loss is not so catastrophic as, you know, a farmer that has a million acres of corn.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's why they're protecting themselves and can do it so cheaply, is because they have all these chemicals and things that protect their assets. And make it very cheap for the consumer to purchase. But, you know, we, and of course you probably could guess that we would say this, you know, we really believe that, you pay for it sometime. You either pay for it now or you pay for it later. So that's kind of how it works. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And, you know, and I have found that in my own life that, you know, now that I'm eating healthier and stuff, I don't get sick nearly as much. And if I do get sick, it's like a couple of days, whereas it used to be a couple of weeks at least.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you look at it in terms of, well, I'm saving money on sick days, I'm saving money on productivity, I'm saving money because I feel better. You know, I just don't feel like, why am I so tired?
Yes.
I used to feel that way all the time. It's like, you know, I just thought of myself as a person that didn't have very much stamina and, you know, could only get so much done in a day. And now it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I can work for hours. I can jog and, you know, and I haven't even jogged, like, and I'm fine, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's just amazing how much different you feel and how you didn't even know you felt so bad when you start feeling really good. So, anyway.
And that's common. I had a client come in, or this was a patient in the hospital whose blood sugar was over 1,000. And it was, I mean, that's catastrophic. I mean,
he had to go to the ER.
He did. He went to the ER and something happened and he had to come to the emergency room and he was in denial that he had diabetes. And I said, your blood sugar is over 1,000, over 1,000. And, for those of you that don't know, 70's great, 80's great.
I was going to say, it's 1,100.
So over 1,000 is catastrophic. And, we got his blood sugar down during his hospital stay, obviously, and it was like coming out of a fog. He had no idea how bad he felt. You can barely function at that point, but it happened so slow. Like you said, you don't even know that you feel bad
until you feel good. You just sort of assume, like, this is normal, and I don't, you know, I just can't wake up in the morning, and I, you know, have to take a nap in the afternoon, and I take a week off, you know, at a time to recover from a cold, and...
And that's just life, and then all of a sudden you feel good, and you didn't realize you felt bad.
Right.
It happens a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. And even with, you know, I mean, something like bowel movements, you know, people think like, oh, well, if I'm going 3 to 4 times a day, that's just normal for me, you know?
Yeah.
And that activity of commercial really hammers that, you know, home or whatever. Yes. Like, oh, I thought that was normal. But anyway, it's just, you know, it's just interesting. Once you regain your health, you didn't even know you didn't have, it, you know, it makes such a huge difference in your life. So anyway, so you pay for it now, or you pay for it later. But there are ways, I mean, you have to have the money. I mean, obviously you can't just invent dollars. I mean, some people do, we won't mention who, but anyway, so some of the, you know, really good ways to save some money are, well, first of all, to garden, to grow your own stuff, because vegetables are very expensive nowadays. And not only that, but I think they don't taste as good as they used to in the grocery store. It just seems like, you know, every time we buy tomatoes, it's like, oh, this is just, it just doesn't taste like anything. It's hard. And
more often you get a flavorless one than you do come across a flavorful
one. Like, it's unusual to get a yummy one.
Yes, I agree.
So, you know, so gardening is, it's extremely rewarding. If you have children, they can help you. Even little bitty kids, they can help you. Like I said, just plant a couple extras for them to destroy.
And they get so excited when they pull something out of the garden, a food they would never eat.
Yeah.
They're so proud of it, and they have this attachment to it. And
there's really something to say for working outside and working with the land, and I think it's just very rewarding, and I think human beings just really have a connection that they, you know, sometimes don't even know about with the land, so... some things are extremely easy to grow, like beans, you practically can't mess up. tomatoes, you can grow. People say corn is easy. I have a brown thumb, not a green thumb. And I've never had a successful yield of corn yet, but I think this year is going to be good because my corn's really doing well so far.
Okay.
So we'll see. Squash is really easy. Herbs are extremely easy and so wonderful for cooking. We just love fresh herbs. It just makes a huge, huge difference.
It does.
I didn't even know that herbs really add to, you know, it's just sort of like, add some dried rosemary. Oh, okay, well, I don't really have to, but I guess I will.
Yeah.
You know, but when you start using fresh herbs, it's like, oh my gosh, these actually taste like something.
The food comes alive.
Yeah, it's just
amazing.
And
they are easy. They're very easy.
Herbs are very easy.
For the most part, I can't get cilantro to grow. But yes, I've never had luck with cilantro.
Oh, I have some growing. But I've never had luck with... I've tried a couple other weird ones, and I always end up killing them.
Yeah.
but I have rosemary. Well, I just buy a rosemary plant, so that's sort of cheating. But anyway, rosemary, oregano is really easy. Basil is easy.
Thyme is easy.
Which herb was I just thinking? Oh, actually, well, most herbs are actually considered weeds, and so they just are very prolific and grow so easily because they haven't been really all that cultivated, and they're more like a what you might find in the wild. So,
yes, which leads me to say, if you plant mint, I recommend planting it in a pot to contain it.
It takes over. Some people use it as a cover crop for their rows in between their beds of gardening, and then you can walk on it and you smell mint walking through your garden.
Yeah,
and I think it can deter some pests too because. The smell confuses them, and they'll stay away from the tomatoes because they smell mint. Anyway, so gardening is a wonderful way to save some money. And even if you have very little space or live in an apartment, you can do stuff like the topsy-turvy tomato.
Yes.
I talked to a lady once that did a potato plant. She did one plant and just kept piling tires around it, higher and higher and higher. And like eventually, it got to the point where she had to stand on a ladder. And she had this one tomato plant that went all the way up the tires. And when it was, you know, when the frost came and the tomato plant died, it came time to harvest. She just pushed the whole stack of tires over. She didn't have to dig for potatoes. They were just all were right there.
Oh, how funny.
And what she had put in the tires was straw. You just, every time the plant grows up a little bit, you put some straw and stuff, you know, leave a couple of inches of the plant sticking out and then add another tire.
That is funny. I haven't heard that method.
So it's a very cheap, you know, you only need one seed potato and which you don't have to buy like quote unquote seed potatoes. You can just buy organic potatoes and just save one that has a couple of eyes on it. Use that as your sprouting potato. You don't have to buy a lot of the stuff they tell you have to buy to do things like this. It's really, I mean, seeds will grow, potatoes will grow.
In college, I gardened on my balcony.
Yeah.
I had tomato plants, pepper plants, tons. They were huge, and I would have the whole balcony full.
And now they have varieties that actually do extremely well in pots.
Yeah.
So just look for those when you're, you know, if you really are limited on space. So, besides gardening, it's a lot of work, but it's fun. There are other things you can do, like, making your own breads and tortillas and biscuits and muffins and things. Because, you know, when you buy a processed food, there's been a lot of packaging, a lot of transport, a lot of, additives and processing that adds to the cost. And it really, you know, especially like a little pack of tortillas are probably like $2 or $3 now at the store. Whereas, you could make the same number of tortillas. They're more nutritious. They're fresher. And it might cost you a third of what it costs to buy them at the store. I remember pricing out homemade bread once, and I figured out that it cost me about, using all organic ingredients and stuff, it cost me about 75 cents per loaf.
Oh, yeah.
It's really cheap. And I think that was with my labor, too.
And we've even taken it a step farther, and we invested a little over a year ago in a grain grinder.
Mm-hmm.
And I can buy a $20 bag, huge, I don't know how it might be a 20-pound bag. I don't know.
No, this big ones are 50. Yeah, the 50 $20 pounds, sounds about right. Yeah.
$20 for a 50-pound bag of wheat berries, of the whole wheat grain, unground. Grind it myself, and it lasts a year. So for $20, you can pretty much use a year's worth of flour.
That's amazing. Whereas most people probably spend $20 on bread in less than 2 months.
Right. So. And, you know, and this is just, you know, I mean, gosh, I wouldn't even know how much a loaf of bread costs now. I mean, it's so minuscule. Right, yeah.
I'm paying myself to make bread.
That has been a huge blessing. It was a good gift.
Mm-hmm.
Very good gift.
You can, you know, I bought a grain grinder also through a friend, and I got it for like $100, but this thing probably cost $300 new. You know, and just watching the paper, watching ads, we kind of browse Craigslist all the time just for fun.
Yes.
And we always find great deals on there, the things we weren't even necessarily looking for, but could have used, and it happens to be a really good deal. So if you have a little, you know, fluff money set aside for stuff like that, that's a really good way to, you know, to capture deals when you're not desperate, so you have time to shop. But, yes. You know, anyway, another wonderful way to keep food costs down is to raise your own chickens. And again, that's becoming more and more popular. A lot of cities are allowing people to raise backyard chickens. I think they limit, you know, they say you can't have a rooster and you can't have more than X number of chickens. And obviously if your chickens are escaping and pooping all over the neighborhood, that could be a problem. But you know, just keeping a dozen chickens, it doesn't cost very much. It's fun. Again, if you have children or even if you don't have children, it is just so rewarding, to raise an animal, to take care of it yourself and then go and harvest food from it, you know? And if you're afraid, you know, at the end, chickens only lay for about 2 years. So if you are dealing with, you know, what to do with the chicken after that, I know some people that keep them as pets. I wouldn't recommend it, but so if you you know, if you decide at the end of your hen's life that you need to get rid of her and you don't want to do her in yourself, a lot of people will take a free chicken, you know, and process it for meat. Sometimes people will even process the meat for you and for them if you split it with them or whatever, so you don't have to kill them yourselves, you know, or whatever. But it's also, you know, you can think of it in terms of it's a, you know. Processing an animal for food is a very vital skill, and people have been doing that for hundreds of years, thousands of years, up until, you know, the day of refrigerated trucks, and people didn't have to kill their own chickens anymore for food, so.
Fairly recent.
Yeah, it's actually very recent. And it sounds gruesome and cruel and all this stuff, but we were given animals to eat by God, and they are what make us healthy if they're raised right. At least that's what I believe. So processing your own chickens, you know how they were raised and how they were killed and that they had a really good life, and, you know, and so you can feel good about, like, I'm going to use this chicken from day one to day, the last day, and take good care of it so that I can feel good about eating it.
Chickens are a hot, I'm sorry to interrupt, I thought you were done. Chickens are such a hot topic right now. That would probably be a good podcast on just raising your own chickens. And
it's actually really easy. I wouldn't do like a million to begin with. Just start with six, because if you kill six, it's not that big a deal. It's not a huge financial loss.
Well, my sister lives in Aspen. And she lives up on a plateau where mountain lions and bears and, you know, they just have a lot of threats in their area.
Sounds fun.
Yeah. And I think the first year her neighbor bought chickens, he bought like 15 and had two live. You know,
you have to get a few.
A bit of hostile area and make sure they bring them in early enough in the evening to.
I had a friend say it to me like this, you know, get a couple to work the kinks out with. And then after that, up your numbers, because you can get chickens practically year round. Either, you know, local feed stores, hardware stores, or you can mail order. Mail order chicks are actually pretty cheap. Cheap. Anyway, it's a nice way, you know, to not, like, spend. I mean, because a baby chick will cost at least $1. So, you know, if you get 50, you're going to spend probably close to $75 on shipping and everything. And if they got all eaten by a couple of rats in one night, or a snake, or a dog, or, you know, whatever, then it's a big financial loss, and you're not going to be very encouraged to try it again. So,
and if you're locally, a neighbor and I were just talking the other day, about 2 years ago, they passed an ordinance in our town not to have chickens about the time that major cities are all busting at the seams with chickens, and our little podunk town outlaws chickens.
Oh, dear.
So if you would like to jump on the bandwagon of fighting that ordinance, there are a small band of us that are interested in doing that. But I'm not tackling it alone. I just can't add one more.
I know, really.
One more food agenda to
But, you know, if you... Not that I'm telling you to break the law, because I'm not. You should always follow the law. But if you have really nice neighbors and you don't get a rooster, you may never be found out that you actually have a few chickens in your backyard. So it might not be that big a deal. But I don't know what they would do to you if they did catch you. But anyway, don't ask, don't tell. they make you take your chickens out back and shoot them or something. Well, you know, speaking of neighbors, another good way to save money is to barter with farmers. A lot of times farmers need extra labor and can use, you know, some skilled labor in exchange for food. Or you can trade services like accounting if you're an accountant, or if you're a hairdresser, or, you know, whatever skills you have. If you are able to do something but not necessarily able to farm, trade with your farmer, because we need a lot of services too. And that can be a really good way, you know, because farmers can we like to barter. We barter for chiropractic care. We barter for, you know, just different things whenever we can. And so we're definitely open to that. We need cash too sometimes, but, you know, anyway.
I know a lot of CSAs, community supported agricultures, work that way too for labor.
Oh, yeah. Get a discount or whatever.
You know, if you want to come work and you get a discount, mm-hmm. work in the fields. And if you have kids, they often love doing that.
It's really good. I mean, people think like, oh, well, don't make your, you know, kid work or whatever. But it's really, really good for people to work with their hands in the outside. It is just so rewarding. Now that we've been doing it for a few years, I just like crave it. I can tell I need to go outside and do something. I'm stressed. I'm tense. I feel like I just need to get out and move and do some stuff. And you don't have to really break a sweat, you know. You don't have to get really dirty. Just go out and, you know, pull some weeds or, it's just very rewarding. I don't know what it is about working outside, but it really is rewarding. Okay, so on to more specific food things. I just had made some notes about, you know, things that are cheap. Now this does not apply to everyone. It does not apply at our house because my husband really can't eat a lot of beans at all. The protein in beans is just very hard to digest. They have a lot of things that are difficult to break down for people with problems, you know, problematic intestines. But if you don't have problematic intestines and you sprout your beans, you know, soak them overnight, then they're fine usually for people. And they're a very cheap source of protein, especially if you mix them with something like corn or rice. It makes that amino acid complete. Christina would know more about that than I do.
You don't actually have to even do it at the same meal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Well, the old rule of thumb for vegetarianism is that you would have to make a complete protein out of each meal. It's certain legumes with certain grains make a complete protein because plant sources on their own are not a complete protein like animal proteins. They don't have all the correct all the essential amino acids to make a complete protein. But years ago, they realized that as long as you're eating a variety in a 24-hour period, mm-hmm. And eating the grain and the bean sometime in that 24-hour period, mm-hmm. your body's going to put it together, whether it's in that minute mm-hmm. or in later that hour or that afternoon. So you don't have to do that the complete meal at the same meal. But at the same time, most things that go together are rice and beans. Grain, right?
Right.
I guess it's useful science, but for the most part, we're going to eat them together anyway. Yeah. It just makes sense.
Yep. And, you know, a very nourishing meal, for example, would be red beans and rice made with broth instead of water, and some, you know, good, you know, the best sausage that you can buy, whatever, you know, whatever that might be, whether it be grass-raised or at least organic or, you know, whatever. But that's, you know, that's a wonderful way. A lot of recipes I've noticed tell you to skim the fat on things like that, like on red beans and rice and stews and whatever. But here's a secret to eating for the cheap. If the fat actually is what fills you up. It makes you feel full. A fat-free meal, you are going to be starving, at least if not immediately after the meal, probably close to an hour later. And so I actually cheat every time I make rice, I always add fat, whether, you know, like it's lard or butter or whatever. You just cannot eat nearly as much rice as you would have thought that you could eat if you add some fat.
It makes it more palatable as well.
Mm-hmm. It may add some flavor. It's really nice. So I do that every time I make it. In fact, what I normally do is I make a big, huge pot of broth, and then I freeze it into yogurt containers that are about a quart each. And then I just take one of those out when I need to make rice, and I make 2 cups of rice with my quart of broth, and the broth almost always has a nice thick layer of fat on top, so that just sort of mixes into the rice and adds some flavor. Sometimes I supplement a little more if it looks like I don't have a lot of protein, you know, animal protein available for the meal. one of my favorite meals to make for, like, you know, super eco whatever is chicken tacos. with rice. You mix rice into the chicken, and you end up eating probably like 4 ounces of chicken or less. It's just like a tiny, tiny little bit of chicken. No, I guess it's probably less than that. 4 ounces of meat is a good amount of meat. But you just mix it in. You add plenty of fat. You know, serve it with sour cream and lettuce, tomato, cheese, whatever. And it's a very filling meal, and goes a really long way too. Especially if you are paying $20 a chicken, yeah, or more. You can get away with serving a quarter of the chicken for a 4-person meal, which is a really good deal. So a couple other just quick tips. Making your own stuffing is really good. A lot of people don't think in terms of like stuffing, you know, they just buy the stuffing mix, which I'm sure is much more expensive than making it yourself.
I've never bought stuffing mix.
All stuffing is, you can make it two ways. You can make it either with flour-based bread or corn-based bread. And so you either make cornbread and toast it and then add your seasonings and your broth and the different things. Or you make biscuits, which is how I like to do it. I make biscuits and then I crumble them up and toast them and then make my stuffing from there. Just normal, you know, and it's wonderful. It's really good. It's really cheap. And it's kind of a comfort food too that goes a long way with a meal. So that's a fun way. You don't have to just serve it at Thanksgiving. It's just a fun way to make a meat go farther. Another thing is soups, or quiches, egg quiches, yes, with leftovers. A really nice way to reuse some leftovers, especially if you have assorted things in the fridge like I do. I usually have like a little tiny thing of this, a little tiny thing of that. Throwing it all into a soup or a quiche is a really nice way to disguise it and make it, you know, not waste it.
Or a frittata, then you don't have to have crust.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We like the crust. We make our own lard, so
for some reason, my husband will try anything, and believe me, over the years, I have tested that diet-wise. I mean, I've brought in some strange foods into our house, but quiches freak him out.
Really?
Isn't that odd?
I never liked quiche until I started making them myself. I tried them at restaurants and cafeterias and stuff, and yuck.
His mom used to make them growing up, you know, fairly often, and I think it was kind of a clean-out-the-refrigerator thing.
Yeah.
And, for some reason, he does not like that. He does not like pot pies either. He is against pastry crust for an entree.
Oh, wow.
I think that's really what it is in our house. That's what it comes down to. There should not be a pastry crust included in an entree.
That's funny.
I don't know why.
Well, I found another trick to quiches, because I'm not a big fan of dry eggs. And quiches, a lot of times, that's sort of the, you know, like, oh, it's dry. It's kind of, I don't know, rubbery. Is to include some cream, or at least don't cook it so much that it's totally dried out. You want it a little bit moist, and the cream will help with that if you have cream. But at least, you know, just don't overcook it. So
they do get rubbery.
Yeah, they do turn rubbery if you overcook them. Broth, again, you know, that's a wonderful way to supplement protein in your diet. It's a really easy to digest protein, and it's very nourishing for joints and intestines and things like that. And what's nice about broth is bones are cheap, because hardly anybody buys bones. You know, when we have animals processed, the butchers kind of look at us crazy, like, you know, you want to keep the bones? What for? And we're like, broth. Yeah, I mean, we don't, you know, tell them necessarily, but you can make wonderful soups as appetizers, which will really help a meal go farther. It seems like if you eat a multi-course meal, you eat less overall, yeah, because it's not like, you know, I'm just going to eat this casserole and stuff myself full. It's, I have, you know, several small different entrees to look forward to, like French onion soup. It's really easy. It's a really nice way to use beef broth.
Our CSA that we belong to, we've had massive amounts of onions, and what somebody said, let's make French onion soup.
I love French onion soup.
I mean, it was like, we eat a lot of onions, and yeah, we were having trouble, and they were not full-grown onions, because mm-hmm, it's not time for them to be full-grown yet, so it was not like something you would store and put away. It was more the green onion form, uh-huh, but the bulb on the end was a little bit bigger, uh-huh, and so everybody's been making French onion soup in our CSA to use up, yeah, those onions.
We also, you know, again, really cheap source of food, because it just does not sell that much, is animal fats, like beef fat and pork fat. Get it from a pasture-raised source.
Definitely.
But anyway, if you have excess beef fat or pork fat, especially if you process in bulk, you can ask for those things to be set aside and keep them in your freezer.
Yes, because using butter and coconut oil gets expensive from good sources. If you're buying good sources, mm-hmm, it gets expensive. Mm-hmm.
So keeping beef fat is just very cheap when it comes from, you know, an operation like ours. I mean, comparatively so. And I forgot what I was going to say about it. beef fat. Oh, yeah, yeah. We use it to fry onions and make onion rings, which are extremely filling and very delicious. You know, fried foods are not great all the time, but fried in a natural oil, or not an oil, but like a saturated fat like beef fat or lard. Sometimes I do a combo of beef fat and lard. And as long as you don't get your oil too hot, fried foods, you know, are fine occasionally. And actually, they can be a nice source of good saturated fat.
But if it's smoking, it means your oil is too high, and those oils are rancid, which means at that point they are toxic to the body.
Right. And of course, if you know are burning your oil, you're probably burning your food too. Yes. So that's a good rule.
So
rule
lots of free radicals and
yeah,
and
just
then you have problems.
Ignore what the cookbooks say. They a lot of times, I mean, they're you know telling you to use vegetable oil or peanut oil or whatever to fry in because they're afraid of cholesterol. But and they tell you do it at like 400 degrees. 400 degrees is awfully hot, especially for cooking in oil. And typically, if I get my oil higher than like 375, it starts to smoke. So. Don't go higher than that. Even with animal fats, just don't go real hot. Just do it based on, where you see before you see smoke and if things are frying, okay. And I guess, as far as food ideas, that was all I had. I guess the last tip would be utilize casseroles when you serve steak or roast chicken or, pork chops or whatever, you tend to eat a lot more meat, which is usually the most expensive part of the meal. And so if you don't serve just plain meat by itself, but rather put it in a casserole of some kind, or serve it with some filling sides, like, rice mixed with lots of fat or butter, stuffing made with, broth and also some fat, it can go a little bit farther. But we really are big fans of casseroles. For one, they're easy, and there's one dish, I don't have time to do a lot of cooking. And I just like casseroles. They're kind of a comfort food, too, so.
Casseroles freak me out.
Really?
I don't know. I don't like, I mean, I'll eat them, but, I'm not a big fan of everything being in one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It gets old. It definitely gets old.
It does. I tend to, try to stretch out the meat by, we'll put it over a salad, or I'll, soups, other things you mentioned, but, I tend, especially being in a CSA where we get so many vegetables a week, I like to make a bunch of sides and cook them all at once and then reuse them out throughout the week. I may reuse them as plain side dishes again, where you have four side dishes, or three side dishes and a salad. I may reuse them again the week just as side dishes and they're already cooked and ready to go, depending on whatever meat I pull out that night. Or I can reuse them in a different form, like putting them in a frittata, or then later putting them in a casserole or a soup or whatever. But I find if I cook a bunch at once, usually the day after we get our bucket of fresh veggies, then they're all right there waiting just to be utilized.
Nice. Yeah, that's one bad thing about serving a bunch of sides is it takes a long time to prepare them all. And if you're anything like me, I'm so spacey, I'm like, oh no, I forgot the green beans. Here it is dinner time, I forgot them. So much for that. We'll have meat and potatoes again.
Yeah.
Now we cannot do a lot of, fresh veggies or salads. So we have to, kind of make do elsewhere, otherwise. And a lot of people are also on low carb diets, which, of course casseroles tend to be very carb heavy and you got to watch out for that. So a nice way to get around that is to include things like squashes. Squashes make for really good bread substitutes. They're still somewhat starchy, but not nearly as much as just plain old bread. Or rice.
Not as difficult to digest either.
Yeah.
They don't have the gluten.
So like zucchini makes a wonderful substitute for lasagna noodles. We used to make, when we were on the specific carbohydrate diet, we used to make a wonderful zucchini lasagna where you just layer it, just the same except zucchini sliced thin instead of noodles. Lots of cheese, things like that.
Spaghetti squash, a lot of people use that. There's a lot of good recipes out there for spaghetti squash for starchy food that's easily digested but less processed than pasta.
Yep. And of course you can make, now these are expensive, but you can make nut-based breads.
Oh, yeah.
They're really expensive. We used to do that too, the almond flour and all that, but I mean, it adds up really fast.
You can grind your own almond flour though.
Yeah.
I did price it out. We buy almonds in bulk and soak them and dry them ourselves and make our own almond butter, and it is much cheaper than buying peanut butter almond butter store-bought.
Nice.
Definitely buying them. So we buy the peanuts in bulk and the almonds in bulk, and it is cheaper. I forgot how much. Maybe like $2 less a jar.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe
that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, because we
considering
we
not like, how big the jar is.
Yeah, it's like $4 or $5 for one little
right.
jar.
Right. Yeah. So it is less expensive to make those, mm-hmm. and those are easy. You can look those recipes up online and
food
find
processor.
Recipes. Food processor, and you're good to go. And mm-hmm. oh, the flavor is so much better, especially mm-hmm. if you soak your nuts overnight in salt water and then slow dry them in the oven at about 150 degrees. Mm-hmm. Just dry them out. They have a completely different flavor, and one of the theories behind our food allergies, there's so many, and people feel like it's an accumulation of things that cause these severe nut allergies that mm-hmm. you see today, but then the nuts roasted at a high temperature, like anything, like we've talked about with pasteurization
mm-hmm.
of milk,
mm-hmm.
it affects the nut, and we've got generation on top of generation eating a lot of nuts. Well, I mean, how
That's
many generations
true,
yeah. have lived off of peanut butter
mm-hmm.
the past few? We've done that at a high temperature, eating a lot of roasted
mm-hmm.
peanuts and other nuts. And so that's what's accumulating over generations,
mm-hmm.
Causing increased nut allergies. It's one theory. So we dry ours at a low temperature, but it
mm-hmm.
adds a wonderful flavor, especially to almonds. Almonds are my favorite dried that way. Soaked
mm-hmm.
overnight in salt water and then dried.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just put them in the food processor with coconut oil and a little bit of sea salt. And you can put honey if you want.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter prefers I put honey. I kind of
know. How long will that keep? How do you store it?
I think if you're not going to use it in the next week or two, you'd want to put it in the refrigerator. But
mm-hmm.
we use ours up so fast that,
yeah.
you know, if we make it, we use it. If we don't have any made, we don't use it. But so when it's made, we use it pretty quick and
okay.
we don't refrigerate it.
I'm going to try that because peanut butter kills us, but we love it. You know,
yeah.
it's really expensive. I just haven't ever gotten around to researching how to do it. But that sounds easy enough. So.
It's cheaper, too.
You leave skins on the peanuts?
No, you can try to get them off.
Okay.
Once you dry them, if you rub them in a towel or something, they tend to come off very
okay.
easily. You can pay a little bit more and get them without the skins,
right.
but, you know, if you want to be cheap. And also, with intestinal issues, there's a lot of controversial stuff out there about
mm-hmm.
peanuts and the
mm-hmm.
Mold that's on there. I don't know if you've ever read any
yeah.
of that, that they usually recommend.
Mm-hmm.
For digestibility, people stay away from peanuts. It's a theory that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people in the naturopathic world usually shun the peanuts for the mold that's typically found on them.
Mm-hmm.
So
they can be hard to digest too, and a lot of people have peanut allergies that aren't allergic to anything else, which is kind of odd. Maybe it's the mold.
Maybe so. Maybe
yeah.
that's it. It's it's something that we haven't had a problem with in our family.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we don't consume mass amounts of peanut butter, but
yeah.
we do try to consume other nut butters too, just for the variety of nutrients,
oh,
if
yeah.
nothing else.
Well, almonds are very nutritious. Also.
Oh, that tastes so good.
Yeah, I like almond butter, but it's too expensive to buy. But making it yourself. Another good way to save some money is buying old vegetables or fruits or whatever, making your own jams and jellies. We don't usually like sweet jelly, so we hardly ever add. I mean, when I make my own, I'm talking like I cook them, I put them in the freezer, and I don't really add any. I just add some cinnamon. It makes them taste sweeter without actually adding any sugar. I made a homemade apple and pear butter. The pears really accentuate the apple flavor, so like I just keep it in the freezer, and it's wonderful spread on toast instead of jelly. Not nearly as sugary, you know, but still very nutritious.
But if you can, you cannot leave out the sugar because that's what's curing that and preserving.
That's right. Yes.
So that's for freezing, just to wanna
yeah
throw in that.
That's
safety.
The reason I didn't add the sugar and I stuck it in the freezer is because I didn't want to can it with all the sugar because sugar is expensive too. But you can find old vegetables through CSA programs where they just have old stuff that had to be what we call culled, C-U-L-L-E-D, meaning that it was just, you know, not good enough for sale. But still good enough for a soup or a casserole or whatever because it doesn't necessarily have to be pretty.
Or come at the tail end of the farmer's market day.
Mm-hmm.
If they close shop at 1, come at 12:45.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're just giving away stuff.
Right. You can get it for really cheap. Buy things in season, you know, buying apples in, I don't know when apple season is, but anyways,
fall.
Yeah. but if you try to buy them off season, they get to be more expensive, which is why you see, you know, tomatoes and things in the wintertime really, you know, they're expensive and they're not even very good. It's because you're not supposed to have tomatoes then. It's
yes.
winter. I had read somewhere that, you know, a really good idea is keeping all your vegetable peelings, your carrot tops, your, you know, anything you cut off of a veggie, keep it, set it aside in the freezer and use it for broth. Use chicken bones for another batch of broth. We even collect our chicken bones after people have eaten the chicken off of them.
I guess if you're boiling
it for a couple hours, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But that's a really good way, you know, to not be wasteful, but also to save money, you know, because, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the top of the carrot. It's just we've always been taught to cut it off and throw it away.
Yeah.
And same thing with the carrot peelings. I quit peeling carrots because it's like, it's a waste of time. It's not really much different than the inside of the carrot. It's, you know, just wash it off and, you know, a little dirt can't hurt you, especially if it's organic dirt. and that's fine. I guess one last note, because we're probably running out of time.
We're pretty close, yeah.
Is replacing beverages with homemade beverages, like water kefir, which is sort of like a soda. We make kombucha, which is a fermented sweet tea, and I buy the ingredients for it at Sam's, because you don't have to use special sugar. You know, you can get away with white sugar, because the kombucha eats it all anyway. But it's very refreshing, especially during the hot months. It's a nice replacement for Gatorade or even just sweet tea. It, you know, just has more beneficial acids and less sugar than straight up sweet tea.
I have a recipe for that on my website. I'll put a link to kombucha.
Yeah.
And they sell it at the health food stores, and it's expensive.
Yeah.
And you can make it for next to nothing.
And you could sell it. Just don't tell anybody. Anyway, but kombucha is really refreshing. It's a summertime drink. We use it when we're working outside because it really helps you just feel, you know, you need electrolytes and stuff. Water's not quite enough if you're working hard outside. But it improves your digestion. I actually sometimes drink it if I have a stomach ache for some reason, and it usually cures it. Maybe it would have gone away on its own. I don't know, but it seems to help. Anyway, we really like that, and it's very cheap to make.
Yogurt is another one.
Yes.
Cheap to
homemade
make.
Yogurt is so, even if you're paying like $10 a gallon for your milk, it is still so much cheaper to make it at home than to buy it at the store.
And higher quality.
Yes, that too. And you know what's in it, you know how much fat is in it, and they didn't homogenize it or anything. Just stay away from like small containers of things, little, you know, individual packages of yogurt, individual packages of cheese, because that's how people make money.
Individual packages of drinks.
Yeah.
Or, you know, anything. Yeah. Anything packed small.
Yeah. Because they, you know, it looks like you're buying, you're spending less, which you are spending, you know, fewer dollars, but you're certainly spending more per ounce or whatever.
Definitely more per ounce, yeah.
So, and, you know, it's hard, it's really hard to adapt your budget to saving up and buying a half a cow a year instead of buying beef every week at the store. Or, you know, buying a 20-pound bag of almonds instead of just buying a couple of pounds every month.
Yes.
It takes some tweaking, it takes some planning, and, you know, you have to learn to make your budget work, you know, because you have to really plan ahead, but you still have to eat in the meantime. But it can be done, and it's kind of fun, you know, because it's like, oh, it's chicken season, let's buy some, you know, a whole bunch of chicken in bulk. Or it's, you know, tomato season, let's buy a bunch of tomatoes and can them ourselves. And even that is so much cheaper because you can reuse the jars and,
making salsa and freezing it. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to, if canning's intimidating, freezing it's a good.
Yeah. Yeah. And freezers are cheap. They really are.
They are.
And they're pretty cheap to run, too, if you get the chest freezer kind, not the upright, but the chest freezer.
The Energy Star and all that. Yeah, there's a lot of things that, basically, if you stay away from anything prepackaged, anything
much.
With the health claims, like we talked about at the beginning, you're going to save money.
These Rice Krispies will save your life.
Yes.
But they'll kill your wallet. So, anyway, good luck eating and stretching your chickens. Hopefully, you really... I just hope that people who choose to eat organic and pasture-raised and natural, you know, and homemade things, I hope they really see a return right away from doing that. And just in terms of how they feel, you know, fewer sick days, you know, less doctor's bills and stuff. We don't ever go to the doctor if we are sick, but you know, those times do come, and it just is really nice to be like, it's been a year and I haven't been sick.
Yeah.
Now, you know?
Yes.
It's very nice.
It's a good feeling.
And, well, I was going to mention one other thing, you know, in terms of, and people don't really think about this in terms of health, but like pregnancy-wise, you know, if you can have healthy pregnancies with no complications because of the way you're eating and your lifestyle, that is a huge, I think we ended up paying about $2,400 to have a baby, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculously cheap. Whereas the average birth with no complications now in a hospital is about $15,000. Now, of course, a lot of people have insurance. But that's changing in our society today, that, you know, a lot of people can't afford it, or, you know, opt out of the government, whatever. And
a lot of people I know are self-employed and have their own companies.
Yes.
And they don't have insurance. Right.
And $15,000 for one little baby, yeah. That's an expensive baby.
That's a deciding factor on that second child.
Right. Third child. We're still paying off the first one.
Yeah.
Just thinking about it in terms of that, you're looking at a fifth of the cost of a traditional way of birthing, even just having a baby, you know. We really haven't spent that much on having babies, you know, because we just kind of do it naturally and make our own baby food. And we talked about that in the podcast, cloth diapering and, you know, all this different stuff where you just really end up saving money in the long run. You invest more to begin with, but you save money in the long run. So it can be done.
And you have to think about, too, in our country, we spend less on food than other industrialized countries, and we have the worst health. It seems like when a housewife wants to, who does the budget, needs to find money, they take it from the food budget, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. then they buy junk, and then everyone's sick, and mm-hmm. I'm a budget freak, and I go on a lot of budget discussion boards online. Mm. And it'll be, you know, there'll be contests. See how cheap you can get your diet, and they're buying beanie weenies from the dollar store and stretching it out with rice and mm-hmm. polished white rice that they found at the dollar store. Mm-hmm. And then you see what some people are living on, and it's terrifying.
Yeah. What are they spending their money on, if not food? I don't know. We don't have TV. We don't have, you know, we have a couple phone bills, but we have to for business.
So. Right, yeah. I don't know.
We definitely spend a lot on food. Even being farmers, we spend a lot on food.
Right. It's an investment. It's part of life, and you can't get around it. You have to eat. Mm-hmm.
And eating is not just for fun. It actually has a purpose.
It does have a purpose.
It nourishes your body, or it's supposed to.
Thankfully, it is fun. But anyway, so food for thought. We do spend a lot less, and we have the health mm-hmm. problems to show for it. So it's worth the extra mm-hmm. money.
And it tastes better, too.
Yes.
I think.
Well, as always, we want to hear from you. So if you have any questions or comments, be sure to email us at questions@eatingthegoodlifewithchristinapetite.com. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes page. If you have any questions about this topic or suggestions for upcoming topics you want us to talk about, we would love to hear what you want to hear, or just random questions of things you would like to know. Anything that comes across your mind nutrition-wise, Jerrica could answer farming questions.
Oh, boy.
whatever crosses your mind, we'd love to hear from you. And until next time, happy eating.
Yeah, good luck raising your chickens.